Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's Viewpoints, Jean-Philippe Smith was recently named Canada's new Dominion sculptor. He carves Canada's spirit in stone.
There was a lot of art in the house, books on art. My mom painted and she drew. My dad sculpted some wood and also drew as well. So I was kind of artistic from the start.
The Value Fiddlers were silenced by the COVID-19 epidemic, but nothing will keep them from celebrating 25 years of music in Buckley Valley, BC.
We have a tradition of having mentors come visit us from all across Canada. Part of our repertoire is either, well, it's either all written for us or arranged for us. It's so cool. It's lovely.
And we'll go to British Columbia, where there seems to be a shortage of firewood on Cortes Island. You might learn you're not paying that much for yours. Prices are exploding and residents are converting to gas.
I'm hearing people buying cords from Quadra for $500. There was a guy coming over from the Big Island there doing three cords for $1,000.
This and more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Bristol resident Jean-Philippe Smith was recently named Canada's Dominion Sculptor. He now becomes the sixth person to hold this title since it was created. A Dominion Sculptor carves Canada's spirit in stone, essentially for the Parliament buildings. Mr. Smith has worked for several years as an assistant to outgoing Dominion Sculptor Phil White, who recently retired. Jean-Philippe Smith was raised on a farm in Bristol, Quebec. That's where he picked up some artistic habits, he says, mainly from his parents. And after leaving to study and to work in the big city and spending time working in sales, Smith decided he needed a change. He enrolled in the Heritage Masonry program at Algonquin College. He then spent some time in Europe and honed his craft alongside with some real masters of the field. When he returned to Canada, Smith joined the parliamentary sculpting team in April 2018. He's now the head honcho of the Dominion Sculpture team. Our Pontiac journalist Caleb Nickerson had a chat with him.
So we're here with Jean-Philippe Smith, the newly named Dominion Sculptor for Canada. Jean-Philippe, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, not so bad. So before we get into your new job here, could you talk a little bit about your connection to the Pontiac and your background more generally in sculpting?
Sure, okay. So I grew up in the Pontiac. More precisely, I grew up in Bristol. My parents have a farm there, 350 acres. My dad was a farmer and a municipal counselor. My mom, a teacher at McDowell. It was... I would say it was a wonderful upbringing. I spent a lot of time playing in the hills behind the house with my brother and my sister. But I also remember spending a lot of time in Norway Bay at the beach as well. So it was a fantastic upbringing in the Pontiac. I remember also as a youngster always doing art. There was a lot of art in the house, books on art. My mom painted and she drew. My dad sculpted some wood and also drew as well. So I was kind of artistic from the start. And after several years of living in the city, I really felt like I wanted to move back to the country. And in 2016, my wife and I bought a small farm.
And you had kind of a roundabout a way of arriving at the trade of sculpting there. Can you describe how you got into it initially?
I went to university at the same time I was working as a doorman at the Chateau Laurier. And I really enjoyed that. And once I finished university, I stayed with Fairmont Hotels. I worked for several different hotels. And then I found myself at the head office in Toronto in one of the tall office towers in a small cubicle environment. And one of my coworkers there was feeling the same way and came across stonemasonry. And I thought that sounded pretty interesting. So I understood that there was a program in Perth for heritage stonemasonry. And I just went for it. I quit my job and I signed up, and I spent 2 years in school there and learning the trade as a stonemason and then a stone cutter.
You'd done some training in Europe as well there. Could you describe a little bit about, I guess, how the carving scenes compared from Europe to North America?
It's similar, but it's quite different as well. In Canada, it's a very small community, a very tight-knit community. There is work, for sure, but not nearly as much as there is in Europe. There is a lot more stone buildings there. And it's a craft in Europe that is nurtured. There's a lot more knowledge that is passed down from generation to generation, century to century. And my time in France, working in Avignon, was incredible, absolutely magical. Learning tremendous amounts every day from carvers who had started in the trade from the time they were 16 years old. I mean, I had learned from their father. It was incredible.
And so how did you get your start with the parliamentary team there?
This opportunity came up for assistant to the Dominion sculptor. And I thought, well, this could be something great.
Sounds like an interesting role or a little department there that most people might not really realize even exists. So can you talk a little bit about what exactly you guys do and what your responsibilities are?
The main one these days is to ensure the maintenance of the sculpted elements, plaster, wood, metal, or stone, that are part of the parliamentary precinct, to ensure that the conservation and repairs to these pieces, and sometimes replace them if need be. So they are quite important pieces. They're often pieces that represent the flora and fauna of Canada, and also the story of the Canadian people. Also, we do create new works, and that kind of falls in line with the vision that the original architect had in 1917 when they recreated Centre Block. At the time, the architect Pearson had in mind to create a decorative arts program that would continue for future generations. And during the construction, he installed blocks that are earmarked for carving but were left blank. So in the following years, sculptors continued to carve these blocks and to tell the story of Canada. Today, there remains 188 blocks that are left uncarved. So part of our mandate now is to look at continuing that tradition. And we now have access to some of these blocks that were inaccessible for over 100 years. So we have a great opportunity to go ahead and continue this carving tradition.
That's interesting. You beat me to my next question here. I was just about to ask, is there opportunities for creativity as an artist yourself, or is it just mostly a lot of sort of repairing and restoring what's already there? But you kind of beat me there.
Yeah, no, there certainly is some opportunities for artistic creativity. But we always have to, it's also a trade and it has a specific style. So we also always have to respect the elements of the style and the tools that are used, so there is some freedom.
I guess you're also constrained too by the type of stone and also like where exactly on the building these things are located or the ones that are left.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some stones that are much easier to carve. They'll take a lot more. You can put a lot more detail in the stone, and there's some stones that aren't that much fun to carve. And sometimes you have to go about it a different way.
Is there a good deal of that kind of variety on Parliament Hill, or?
Yes, there are. There's mostly sandstones and limestones. There's some granites as well. So there's stones that are from Canada. There's stones that are from the United States. There's stones that are from Europe. So there's quite a bit of variety, yes.
And how big's the team there that you guys have?
Right now, there's just one other sculptor. But we're in the process of bringing on other sculptors to help us with meeting the needs that we're seeing now with all the restoration that's happening, particularly on Centre Block.
I was going to say, yeah, a couple or three guys doesn't sound like a huge, huge team for the amount of work that you're doing there.
But we're getting there. We're getting there.
Awesome. And so just wrapping up here, do you have any personal projects or anything else that you're working on outside of your role there professionally?
There's a sculpture that I've been working on. It's on and off. And it's a bust of my father who passed away a couple of years ago. Yeah, it's an important piece for me. It's a difficult piece to work on, obviously, as well. touches pretty close to home. And I was kind of thinking about it this past summer. Like, why is this taking me so long? And I think one of the reasons is because working on that piece is kind of like spending time with him. So that is a particularly special piece for me, and I'm hoping to wrap it up this winter sometime.
Well, John, Philippe, I want to thank you for your time there. That's a very informative and a very interesting role that you're taking up there.
Anytime at all. Great speaking with you.
The Value Fiddlers began performing as a group in 1997 and are now celebrating their 25th anniversary. A great achievement for this group, whose members range in age from 6 to 60. The Value Fiddlers are based in Buckley Valley, home to a total of 25,000 people in northern BC. This group features fiddlers who play with their friends and family as backup on instruments, from accordion to drums. The group's influences and tunes range from French to Scandinavian to African compositions, and they also feature a lot of Canadian songs, naturally. Our journalist Pamela Hassan, based in Smithers, BC, met with the director of the Value Fiddlers, Leslie Jean McMillan.
When we moved up here, there was already such a huge music scene here, big folk music scene, and everybody was so supportive when we were trying something new, like trying the fiddling. And so everybody pulling with us, I think, is what made Fiddlers happen and what makes so much happen in this valley.
How did COVID impact the Valley Youth Fiddlers? And then do you think that you'll keep any of the changes that you've had to make in regards to your gatherings and concerts, or are you just excited to get back to shows for large live audiences?
Last year, we were only allowed to have people under 18 come, which was, like, we felt lucky we were able to have that even. But we're a whole family and community organization, so we're super happy that we have the adults back. I mean, some changes that we will keep is we now have almost all of the parts that we use are on video, so people can practice with videos. But in terms of our performances, I think, like, we're looking forward to being able to actually play for people together and to be able to crowd together on a stage again. But we're happy that we at least get to do what we get to do now.
Is the Valley Youth Fiddlers, has it always been a bit of a family affair? Like, I noticed it seemed like maybe some parents playing like rhythm guitar, and some of my friends were playing, like Naomi and Jake were on bass and on drums. So being the Valley Youth Fiddlers, are the parents and I guess people, and typically people over 18, are they kind of supplementing what's not being played on fiddle? And has it always been the tradition?
So it started off with that adults could join, but they couldn't play fiddle. And we really wanted parents and families making music together, because that's what folk music is. But then more recently, we let adults start playing fiddle. I was worried in the beginning that if adults played, they'd take over from the kids, but the kids actually keep the adults in line. And so many people have grown up through the Fiddlers. Like, in the beginning, we had no drum, and then Richard Jenny, Jake's dad, offered to play as part of Bongo Fury, and Jake was still just a little kid, like 12, and he was one of our drummers. And so now there he is as an adult leading the whole drum section. And like co-leading the group with me, and Naomi's helping as well. And there are a few now also, some other people that played as kids who are back as adults playing guitar, just because it brings them such happy memories.
So, and I also noticed that there was a song that you played that I believe you said was an original. I kind of missed it. People will write, like they'll compose songs for the Valley Youth Fiddlers, or is that one an anomaly?
So we have lots of tunes composed for us or arranged for us. We have a tradition of having mentors come visit us from all across Canada. And so Oliver Schroer was one of those mentors, and he wrote the Sleigh Bells Waltz for us. And then there was another tune that we used to play but don't often play anymore, that a bunch of the kids had written, which I may bring back in the future. But yes, we always have a large part of our repertoire is either, well, it's either all written for us or arranged for us. We're bringing up James Stevens to work with us, and he's going to give us a tune that he wrote. He's going to teach us a tune that he wrote for one of the kids who graduated and her mom from our group, and then also a tune that one of the kids themselves has written and arranged for the group.
How cool is that?
It's so cool. It's lovely.
Where can people find, like, I mean, I was able to go and see a practice because, you know, I was invited to record it. But can people find you online, or are you going to do an online concert? How could people watch and see it this year, aside from obviously on CICK radio?
So we have the Valley Youth Fiddlers website that has little snippets of us in there. We are soon releasing a story that Patrick Williston, one of our members, wrote for us, that we recorded last spring as a concert. And so that'll get released on something like Spotify in the next little while. And so it'll be on Facebook and hopefully like on our website and everywhere else we can get it out. And then there's little snippets of us here and there from our tours. We were all set up for a tour before COVID struck. So we're waiting. We have another show ready to go, but we have to wait. But there's some little snippets from Alaria's Fiddle, and then also from Fiddle History of Canada and other shows that we've done. You can find them on YouTube if you search Valley Youth Fiddlers.
Leslie Jean wanted to let our listeners know that they're always accepting new members, and if you want to participate, they ask that youths have at least 1 year fiddle experience and for adults to come anytime. You can find out more by visiting their website at valleyyouthfiddlers.com and click on Contact.
That was our journalist Pamela Hassan speaking to Leslie Jean McMillan in British Columbia.
With Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
From carving stone to striking chords to cutting wood, Nick Gagnon started cutting firewood for Cortes Islanders off the British Columbia coast a couple of years ago. He has noted a decline in firewood cutters in recent years, so much so that many people have been running out of wood this winter. Some islanders even had cords delivered from off-island, some paying as much as $500 a cord. Yes, you heard right. Nick Gagnon delivered 60 to 70 cords of wood to Cortes households last year, but figures he barely made a dent in the need for firewood on Cortes. Many people on Cortes Island who heat their homes with wood rely on others to cut their firewood for them. For Cortes Islanders, relying on local cutters to bring them enough firewood to warm their homes each winter, there has recently been a greater feeling of firewood scarcity. The Cortes Community Forest Initiative does provide a consistent supply by bringing logs to roadsides for those cutting firewood for sale, but that is available to loggers at around $100 a cord. Despite the uncertainty of supply and extra work to householders, such as stacking and splitting wood, it is still the most economical choice compared to other heat options, such as propane. Our Cortes Island journalist Kate Madigan met with Nick Gagnon. He shares his thoughts about what's driving this shortage. He also talks about how he loves his newfound job on Cortes Island.
I think a lot of hardcore firewooders packed it in over the last 5 to 10 years. And I also think the result of that is a lot of people did have that 2 or 3 year advance on their firewood, and they've kind of been running out. So, you know, you kind of score 3 cords here and you catch up a little bit. And I think everybody's just kind of run out. I kind of feel like I'm almost the only guy out there sometimes. I mean, there's lots of firewooders, but I think it's just less consistent is another big factor, you know, like as a runaround chainsaw guy too, you come across a cord here and you come across a cord there, but that doesn't give firewood buyers very much security, and it doesn't give, you know, a firewood producer a lot of security as far as being, having a good consistent supply. I think another big factor is the price point on firewood. I always looked at it as firewood is free where it sits, and its only value is the work it takes to get it to your house. You know, that really sort of is the case. So for two guys to go out with a truck and some chainsaws and to hand bomb a cord of fir into the back of a truck and drive it and deliver it to somebody, and for both of them to make $150 and go home that day, you know, that's more like a fun job. That's not really a pay the mortgage job.
I know that I've tried every 10 years or so, I go, I'm going to go get my own firewood. And then I'm reminded about how ridiculously difficult that is. You need the time, the skill, the equipment, and yeah, you need to be fit because it's hard work.
Yeah, it's really hard mechanically. Like, it's really hard on trucks. Just driving around with a cord of fir in the back of a 3/4 ton diesel pickup, it's working. And where are you going to get that firewood? It's not paved. It's probably a rough, flexy, bouncy road with a washout or two. It's not easy on a vehicle, and it's not easy on the body.
Is there not machines that make it easier for you? I know that some people, they cut wood and they don't even touch the wood. Everything is mechanized and so on. It's not how you do it, is it?
I do. I got a couple different setups, and it depends on, for me, whether it's worth the volume to go get set up somewhere. So I got my little mechanized harvester, and I like to buck up everything with that and then still manually process it through a wood splitter. Thing with like a, let's say like one of those big firewood processing machines specifically is, for starters, they're like, you know, $75,000 to $100,000. So that's a big investment to make. You know, those machines can produce like 8 or 10 cords a day. You still need another machine around to load the logs onto it, and you're going to have a pretty serious amount of fuel consumption. And then you also need a pretty serious truck to deliver all that wood. So your setup cost, I mean, you're looking at $150,000 to be able to create, you know, a firewood processor with, you know, a little, let's say, skid steer or something to load it. And then the comparable 2-ton truck or something that isn't stressed out delivering cord after cord of wood.
How much is it for a cord right now?
I'm doing mixed loads for $300.
I think I've heard you say before, it's not like you're going to get all fir. Everyone wants just all fir, and that's just not possible. It's going to be mixed.
Well, like, let's say like bone, like nice dry fir, you know, at the top end, you're going to get 28 million BTUs out of that. And as far as hemlock goes, you're going to get like 19 to 20 something million BTUs out of a cord of hemlock. So if you blend those two together, you're buying 25, let's say 24 conservatively million BTUs for $300. Let's just quickly compare that to propane, which is about 25,000 BTUs per liter. That takes 1,100 liters of propane to equal one cord of, you know, fir, hemlock, mixed. 1,100 liters of propane at $1.80. So you're looking at $2,500 comparatively to heat with gas. So a cord of mixed fir and hemlock, price-wise, versus any other option on the market, it is no question. I feel like the price of firewood is so far per BTU outpaces anything else on the market. And I think that's a big driving factor why it's not so accessible. So I'm hearing people buying cords from Quadra for $500. There was a guy coming over from the Big Island there doing 3 cords for $1,000, $330 a cord. So here I am at $300 a load coming in under the general market, or obviously what people are willing to pay. So to move the buck forward, like, propane goes up 50 cents a liter overnight. We don't want to take advantage of the market or take advantage of people in need of the market being where it is, but it's definitely got to move up a little bit. And I think if it does, that might inspire more people to bring it up. I think it's one of the best entrepreneurial markets. I mean, what else can you do on your own time with a chainsaw and a pickup and as a little side job, the weekend warriors, just to get it done? There's tons of 10-acre lots on Cortez that are full of blowdown fir. Now we're just recirculating the list. We're just going back through our client list and trying to keep everybody served and in fairness. Kind of go into a little bit of a triage mode this time of year. You know, we're getting a lot of elderly people or just people just, I've got nothing left. So to sort of take what you got that's burnable and to get it to people who are, you know, sort of freezing right now, that's really our big priority.
I hear you're saying that anyone who's cutting wood, just make sure it's as efficient as possible. And then, you know, you will do better at this. And there's ways of doing that. And I can't see with the, you know, the cost of fuel, which is up already, what is it, $1.65 in town per liter right now. And it's going up even more. So this is going to have to be transferred on to the cost of the wood that the consumer pays. So, I mean, I don't see any way around that. Do you?
No.
So we should probably be expecting that wood might go up a bit. And so, yeah, and hey, it's a hard job. So, yeah, let's just pay people properly for what you guys provide. And then, yeah, maybe there will be more people more interested in providing firewood on the island if there is a shortage right now.
Right. And of course, the firewood that does come out of the community forest is available to people. So the CFGP has put up a call out to anybody, any firewood contractors who want to buy loads of firewood and process it and get it to market.
You're pretty much it right now. I don't know anyone else cutting wood.
It feels like it. If I can't, you know, if someone calls me to get put on the never-ending list, the eternal list, you know, and I always tell people, even though you're on my list, if you get an offer from anyone else, you just go ahead and take it. I will not be insulted or anything, but the key for us is that we're trying to work with the community forest and just building that capacity and making, and we're going to increase every year how many cords we put out there. And some of the people on our client list who are starting to feel like we can provide them with some firewood security, it's probably one of the most satisfying jobs, because you're bringing people warmth and you're bringing them heat, and hopefully we can get those woodsheds stocked up.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for, you know, looking after us in the community with our firewood.
That was our journalist, Kate Madigan. So this is what ends this edition of Viewpoints, a program produced by the Local Journalism Initiative and presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with the campus and community radios across the country. You can also listen to our programs and reports in French and in English on canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. Tune in to all of the stories produced by our journalists based in British Columbia, Alberta, Quebec, Ontario, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. All of our stories are posted there on a daily basis. They allow us to discover Canada and our local communities from a different perspective. Thanks to our journalists, Caleb Nickerson, Pamela Hassan, and Kate Madigan, and to the artists who grace us with their music, I'm Boris Chassagne. Thanks for being with us.